From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 366, recorded live Thursday, March 4th, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support, online at telerik.com, and by franklins.net, makers of Gesture Pack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Sebastian Lambla about practical rest.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And on the phone right now, we've got Sebastian Lambla, also known as Serial Seb. How are you, sir?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. You are a young person, but I was just going to call you the wise old man of rest, because you've been talking about rest before I even was familiar with the topic. You've been working in rest since the very beginning, haven't you?
Not the beginning, but I think I was formalizing ideas around web technologies all the way back in 2003, 2004, and I stumbled upon rest on late 2004, early 2005, and it kind of resolved a lot of outstanding questions I had. Mm-hmm. So I just got completely hooked on it. It was free for the first hit, and now I'm a rest addict.
A restafarian, I think someone told me.
A restafarian. Yeah, I'm not sure I like the term really, but Open Rasta was a play on restafarian. As a term used, it's the term that people used to call themselves if they were very interested in REST topics.
Mm-hmm. So, and Open Rasta is your REST framework, your server-side REST framework?
Yes, I think it's difficult to qualify it as REST. I think it's a resource-oriented framework. So it takes the ideas that exist in REST and focuses on one side of things, which is to define things with names and builds a whole framework around that concept, which is quite a different approach from the MVC approaches that existed at the time, certainly. So I call it a resource-oriented framework, but you can call it a REST framework. Yeah, it's close enough.
Well, that's actually an interesting thing. So right now, we're only a few minutes in, and we're talking about REST, but already we're parsing words and thinking about, it's kind of like that, it's not quite like that. What is it about REST that brings that out in people, that sense of really wanting to define things and make sure that it's correct and that it's understood? Why does REST do that and other technologies don't?
I think there's two main reasons. The first one is REST is really the way that technology, it's a reflection on the way the web is built itself. So it has the properties that the web has. And when I talk about the web, I took the web as a globality, as all the servers in the world that runs web applications. So there's a lot of experience that has been gained from those web technologies that REST describes. Now, one of the problems is that the majority of people building REST applications have no idea they are building REST applications, because they're building web applications. REST is a reflection on how they built those applications and what the properties of that system, once it's built, are. So I think the first thing is people don't know they're doing REST, so they don't know the rules they followed to build them. They don't know the formalism behind how web applications are built. So you have to, when you bring in REST to a conversation, you not only have to bring the knowledge of REST, you also have to rework the way people think about how they build their web applications. That's one thing. And the other thing, of course, is we have had a lot of vendors using the moniker REST as opposed to web services. Of course, it's a completely different way of building systems. So it's not really something that you put against SOAP, for example. It's not SOAP versus REST. But people have been using it like that, and it went into product names. Some vendors took a long time to learn what REST really meant, and they published a whole bunch of products that were for the REST purists, for the people that really spent many years learning REST, are in conflict with some of the simple rules in REST. So I think the community may have been in the past a little bit touchy-feely because they have to fights the knowledge that people think they have and fights the marketing of the vendors. So the two combined together, especially when you apply that to a very small group of passionate people, may turn sometimes in, you know, very small, cohesive, you did it wrong kind of mm-hmm. groups. I think we suffered from that a little bit in the past. I don't think it's the case now, but I think in the past, yes. I know that the term REST purist has been used a lot. The REST police and many well-known bloggers have, in many occasions, explained how they were being pursued by REST farmers and their pitchforks when they did it wrong. So I think mm-hmm. that's an attitude that doesn't really exist in the community, but it certainly didn't help us very much at the beginning, I would think.
So it sounds like if someone's technology has a fundamental misunderstanding, that's when the purists come out, the defenders, is the idea that, no, you're misunderstanding something fundamental. And I'm hearing you say that REST is an architectural pattern that's built on top of the web itself. And you're saying most people don't even understand how the web itself works when they're designing
Indeed.
Systems for it.
Yeah, that's the truth. But that's because they are middleware vendors. If you had to rebuild a whole web stack every time you build a website, things would take a long time. So you are abstracted away, especially on Microsoft platforms. And again, we're talking circa 2006. On Microsoft platforms, what you had was web forms. You couldn't be further from how the web works. So of course you have a whole generation of developers that are not trained on web technologies. So they don't know what they're doing. Of course they don't. The reason for the vendor to exist is to let them not learn what they're doing so they can focus on resolving business issues. So I think that's part of that problem, yes. But I think it's getting better. I think it's getting much, much better now, especially on the Microsoft side. It's a completely different, new, brand, shiny new world.
That's interesting that you say that, because when I started out, I learned C in school, and when I did my first Hello World, it was with Charles Petzold's Programming Windows book on Windows 3.0, 3.1, and Hello World was 91 lines. So, you know, you had a really clear idea of what was going on. I mean, I learned all about window handles and cleaning up after myself and all the things that are at just the bowels of what was then the Windows SDK. And when I learned Visual Basic, when I went into business and started dragging over buttons onto the surface, it wasn't magic to me. I was like, oh, okay, I see what they've done here. They've just wrapped that, and oh, this button has a window handle. And then I was able to go and use some of the low-level VBX cracking software from people like Dan Appleman, and I was doing, you know, crazy owner draw graphics and stuff, and everyone else thought it was amazing. Because their mm-hmm. foray, their first entrance into Windows was, well, you drag a button, and then you double-click, and then you have button.click.
But I come from the completely opposite background. I started with JavaScript. My first line of code was in 1997. But I did a bit of BASIC and stuff like that before. But the first real products that I tried to launch commercially and make money of, that was in 97, 98, websites, Netscape 1.2. Then we went all the way to building a 3D engine with JavaScript and a Microsoft technology called Direct Animation that no one remembers because it died. Then there was another one from Microsoft called Chrome Effects, but that also died. But in the end, I ended up being called XAML 10 years later. So that's fine. I didn't miss learning all this stuff. But I started from very high level languages, and I delved deeper as I needed to, and things like Windows Handle and to be honest with you, I've been coding in this industry for nearly 15 years. I still don't know how to clean behind myself in C++ because I don't write C++. I know the concepts, I learned them over time, but I never needed them because the language never was part of the projects I was working on. So I think it's not so much where you come from. It's just having that knowledge built over time. We have to accept that a large majority of the developers that we work with are not going to spend all their time learning about the Windows architecture, about languages, about hardware. There's a lot of guys that are just happy doing high-level code, and they happily crank their code at that level. And they will go as deep as they need for their project, but no deeper. And I think that's where I would even advance, and I may be a bit radical in this, I may even advance that the majority of developers that are targeted by vendors are that long tail. I think. I have no statistics, so it's completely Sebastian says, but I think that there's a massive market for people that don't want to learn this stuff, and for VB developers that will never know what a Windows handle is.
But when making stuff in REST, or making just a regular web application, let's say that I know all about the web, but I choose to use web forms or some other, you know, big abstraction, some kind of a, I used to call it personality-driven development, you know? I mean, Scott Guthrie's personality and the personality of the web forms people in the 2002, 2003 timeframe, you know, it came through. They had an opinion. It was opinionated development where they said, if you want to write for our software, you got to buy into the whole worldview. You know, you couldn't get out from underneath it. But now, do you think that we have to know that? Are you disabled in some way if you don't really understand what's happening underneath the internet itself?
I think, I mean, my work is mostly as a consultant, right? So my proper answer for this is my consultant answer. It depends. But I think the reality is people need to learn new approaches like that because of market pressure. The market pressure is to provide nicely designed HTTP APIs that are easy to use. That's what people want. So people that provide APIs need to know how to design nice HTTP APIs. Do you need your HTTP API to be a REST API? Not necessarily. I mean, I design distributed systems. What I do is I'm in front of a big console and I have plenty of little knobs and I turn the little knobs at different intensity levels based on what I want to try and get. So sometimes it means I'm going to get event sourcing in there. Sometimes it means that I'm going to have maybe end service bus in there. Sometimes it means I'm going to have a pure REST API on part of the system. All these components integrate together. But that's because I'm lucky enough in my life I can actually help design the whole system. For developers, if you ask to build an HTTP API, it is probably a good idea to know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Mostly because, as you said, the more people design good HTTP APIs that are more and more RESTful, the more people expect that. And the more people expect that, the more they're going to be wanted. There is a fundamental, right? If developers are happy seeing a nice HTTP API with links, etc., it is not because two or three REST purists are following every developer in the world with a knife saying you'd better put a link in there or else. I think it's because people see the value in it. They wouldn't get excited about it otherwise. So when you see the proliferation of APIs that are happening now, they are happening because developers are learning about how the web works, because developers are learning about how RESTful architectures are built, and because people like them. People like REST APIs. I think that's the fundamental.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that when you're not kind of going against the way that the wind is blowing, things work out better. And, you know, the internet works a certain way, and you try to work against the internet, that's when you get into trouble. And I totally agree with you that REST APIs that feel right are ones that feel like the internet. You know, they don't feel like someone's opinion.
Mm.
So you're doing you're doing classes, presumably all over Europe, on practical REST, but you're also going to write a book on this.
Yeah, that's very exciting. So I've been running these classes for a while, but I've revamped the schedule in the class to have modules, so that I can adapt the format and the times a little bit better to different locations. So we're doing a tour of Eastern Europe soon with that training course. It's called Practical REST, Hypermedia for the Rest of Us. And a lot of the time, I have very particular ways of teaching. I don't really like using slides, and I certainly don't like giving students all the content before they arrive. So in my classes, I'm a bit like your annoying teacher at school. I tend to write on the board and write on pieces of paper and force you to write down stuff. It's just my teaching technique. But at the end, very often people want to have the content in a reusable, indexable fashion. And on top of that, a lot of people very often ask me on Twitter to describe to them something that will take 300 pages to describe. So Twitter is not exactly the best medium for that. So I've had the idea of writing a book that is basically a brain dump of all the stuff I teach in my classes and all the stuff I've learned over the years building systems. And the book is going to be called Practical Rest. And I thought, well, writing a book is a bit of a challenge to start with. So why not make it even worse and attempt to go completely self-published route, just for the fun of it, and see if we can get some leverage on that. And as it happened, Kickstarter started accepting UK projects since the beginning of the year. So I thought, one plus one, let's try and do that. So what we're going to do is publish the publish some details about the book, about what is going to be in there, and the project is going to be on Kickstarter, and you'll be able to reserve your pre-release copy of the book on there. And if we reach the target, I'm going to go and isolate myself in a big house somewhere, very silent, so I can just write all day, and hopefully give a good kickstart in the project, and have a few chapters spitting out quite quickly. So I'm not sure if it's going to work. We'll see. Writing a book without an editor is an interesting challenge. But I think the journey is going to be most of the fun, really. So that's launching end of the weekend, beginning of next week.
So doing a Kickstarter like that, I've got a couple of friends who've done books on Kickstarter, and that's mostly to finance the ability to basically shut off your consultancy and just disappear, like you said, go into a cabin somewhere and write the book.
Yes, I think you need to, because, well, there's really two kinds of books. There are books that just describe how to do specific tasks, or how to write a class or introduction to C#. Things that are reasonably straightforward subjects. When you think about REST, you don't want to be just copying and pasting all the content that already exists out there. You want to be able to formalize a new way of showing it to people. And that requires a lot of thinking. And that thinking can't be interrupted every day by going to a client. So Kickstarter, yeah, the advantage is you can literally just take 4 weeks off, go away somewhere with a whiteboard on your own, and try to formalize a new approach and a new way of teaching that subject. It's really, yeah, it is completely about shutting the consultancy for a little while, yeah.
And will this be done as a PDF, or are you going to actually print, like, self-publish physical dead trees and then give those to people at your training sessions?
Yeah, so it's going to be, so for the Kickstarter, there's three editions. You can get the executive edition, which is going to be leather covered. It's for those people that want to have my words lasting for more than 100 years on their cupboard. Quite a frightful view. But we'll do some funny things, like having a customized USB key saying "Practical Rest, I was there," or something like that. But it also gives you full access to my GitHub account, where I'm keeping the text, so you can actually see the edits live if you so decide, and comment on them and do all this stuff. Then you've got a printed edition. Printed edition will be a signed copy that we will print on wood. And then you've got an online edition, which will be a PDF that you can download to whatever tablet device you may own. So there's going to be the three choices. Moving forward, after the Kickstarter, I'm not sure. I'd like to have it printed, just because I want to be able to give one to my mum.
Well, you should probably try to make sure that you maintain, you know, get like an ISBN number and maintain the copyright, so that if a publisher comes along and says, "Hey, this is great. I see that you self-published this, but we really want to turn this into a book and publish it through a publishing brand." You want to be able to keep that door open, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think It's a difficult one. I've discussed with publishers before, and I know the contracts they usually have. So I think if the book is sustainable as it is, they'll be much more open to discuss how to evolve the book. But certainly what I wouldn't want to be in a situation would be for the book, how would you call that, book intellectual ownership to be owned by someone else. I wouldn't want someone else to be doing the edition version 2 of my book. It's not a series book. It's really, this is a brain dump of Sebastian as of today. This is the only thing that the book pretends to be is a reflection of my thinking on the subject. So I think that would be denatured if some of the control over the future of the book was given to a publisher. But again, if the book has already been published and it's been reasonably successful, publishers are good business people as well. I'm sure we'll be able to have a good conversation on how to move forward. I'm not too worried about it, but yeah, absolutely. I mean, I take your advice on that.
Yeah, I've got a book I've been trying to get out for a long time, using LeanPub. Have you seen LeanPub?
Yes.
Yeah, it is, though. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right to do it this way, because it is the getting it done part, the shutting off your brain and going somewhere else, up in a cabin like Stephen King does. That's going to be the only way you're going to get it done.
Yeah, I think so.
So you did it. You got the class on practical rest. Are you ever going to do that in the States?
I would love to. I would absolutely love to. I love the States. I come as often as I can. As you know, it's a bit complicated to organize Europeans to come and work in the States. So if we have the opportunity and I manage to surround myself with people that know how to push all the buttons of the American government to get the correct visa, then mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love to come and do it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Hopefully, maybe someone from Winelect or Development or Pluralsight or somebody knows how to push those buttons and can make that happen.
Yeah, that would be brilliant.
The other thing that you did that I thought was kind of funny was, you know, I do a lot of things for diabetes research, and you did some stuff for cancer research here. I know that my kids are doing things like they run a certain number of laps, or they do some feat of strength or some physical stress, and then you give them money like, oh, if you can run these many laps, we'll give you $1 for each lap. What did you do recently to raise money?
Well, because I live in the UK, you know, the reputation the Brits have, which is to drink way too much, is absolutely deserved. So, cancer research in the UK had a great idea, which was to get people to get sponsored for giving up alcohol for January, for the whole month. It's called a dryathlon, and you register on the website. You can become a dryathlete. It's a friend of mine that showed me the website. My family has been hit by cancer quite a few times. So I wanted to give a little bit back to the members of my family that went through that. And so I thought it would be interesting to give up alcohol. So I put on a target of £500, which was to give up alcohol in February as well. So we reached that target, and I got an email last week. Count was £702. So we're up £300 short of my original target, which was £1,000, for which I would have shaved my head.
Is there still time? I mean, we might want to get your head shaved. I would love to see that.
Well, the collection for me is not running anymore, but if you click on the link that was on my blog, you can still give to cancer research. We will have to put off the shaving until next year now, but I will definitely do it again next January.
You know, you ought to do that for your Kickstarter.
Well, yes, we could do that, definitely. That's a good idea, actually.
I mean, if they're fans of Rest, they're going to win, but if they want to see you with your head shaved, I think they would also win.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, I'm not sure if anyone cares about seeing my head completely bald, but I think it would be fun. So yeah, we did that, and I'll do it next year again, and I'll continue trying to raise more funds. Mm-hmm. That was my time of the year to give back a little bit.
That's cool. Back to the consulting stuff, you were saying that you do a lot of work in distributed systems. You do primarily all of your work is in consulting. How do RESTful systems fit into like a corporate enterprise? I've always thought that the RESTful stuff happens on the outside when the browser talks to the back end. But if you're going to go and talk to some, you know, big banking system or some certificate system, you might end up bumping into SOAP or WS Security. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that.
I had the privilege, I'll use that word for now, to work in a lot of big financial institutions. How does a RESTful system fit in an enterprise system? Like every other system in an enterprise system, not quite right. I think big enterprise systems, having worked on them, is not as enterprise-y as they sound, in the sense that the majority of banking environments I've been in are grown more or less organically. The reason why there's a lot of WCF and SOAP and WS Security, etc., is just because everybody does it the same way. If someone puts their head out and start doing something else, no one is really, really that concerned, provided you spend enough time going through the security reviews, the architecture reviews, and all the various bits of paperwork you have to do in a bank. After that, you know, one of the beauty is you use the word browser. We use REST when there's a browser and a browser talks to. But if you rethink the problem slightly and you consider that your data entry application, your business-centered application, your trading application is a browser. It just happens to have a completely different user interface to your common web browser, but it is a browser. If you think about it in those terms, so if you think about your system that needs to retrieve stock market values, is also a browser, even though it doesn't have a user interface. It actually doesn't have a graphical user interface. If you rethink each of those independent systems as being browsers, then suddenly you'll find that there's plenty of places when REST apply very well. Now, the advantage we have with web browser, especially in big organizations, things like certificates are already solved. Fundamentally, if you have security that's deployed across the whole of your company, it is going to be deployed for the web browser as well. Now, that means that when you're going to build a REST client, be it that you're going to have a stock market application, or you're going to have a data entry application, or maybe it's just going to be a web app, all those web technologies are already deployed in enterprise. So I would say that the enterprise world is even more ready and available for grabs for REST than other systems, because all the heavy work has been done. You arrive in an environment where the web is already at the core of everything, because everybody uses the browser all the time. Everything is already web apps. Web security is already deployed everywhere. You are actually fast-tracking REST adoption much, much faster than, say, if someone decided to create a completely new web service stack tomorrow. So I think it actually fits very well. The difficulty is more of a political one than really a technological one. From the technology part of things, it's a smooth ride. We've deployed really cool systems. I've deployed a system with one team, which I just think is great. We needed to display a lot of data grids. You know, the enterprise world means data grids, mostly. 90% of what is done in the enterprise is data grids. So we decided to rethink the data grid as an HTML table browser. So basically, your nice WinForm application with all the data grids is just going to get HTML pages. And from each HTML table it finds in the HTML page, it shows a data grid. We solved so many problems with such a simple technology. It's amazing. That's the power of reusing web technologies today. It's funding, it's rethinking what the browser is and what the application is. And when you do that, you leverage so much, so easily. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it is really coming down to making the using the web the way the web was meant to be created, not building in a bunch of infrastructure for things that the company doesn't necessarily support. Just remembering that the company already supports the web and use those technologies.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
That's probably, I like that way of looking at things. So where can people find you online, learn more about what you're doing?
Yeah, I just launched a very badly designed website called serialseb.com. So you can find on there all the talks I give, the locations where I'll be. It's mostly not for me to tell people where I am. It's more for me to remind myself I need to go to certain conferences in case I would forget. And there's a whole section on practical rest. So there will be links on the content of the course, the content of the book, the Kickstarter address, et cetera, et cetera. There's even a media section if you want to download my face and put it in your back on your background on your computer.
Cool. Well, that's great. Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today. And hopefully we'll see Practical Rest in book form very soon.
Well, hopefully. Fingers crossed. I'm aiming for maximum 12 months of work. So I'm sure we'll get there. Thank you very much for having me on the show today.
My pleasure. And then be sure to send me the link, and we'll put that in the show notes so you can find a link to his Kickstarter in a week or so when it goes live.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
All right. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.